Where we are this morning in our Bibles, Luke chapter 2, typically, it's not probably something that's preached at Christmas time here, but here we are, about the birth of Jesus Christ, and I love going through these New Testament books. I love reading about Jesus Christ and preaching about Jesus Christ, and it's invigorating, it's good. It's fun. It's nice. Luke chapter 2. And I will say I struggled trying to figure out how far to go in this chapter. The chapter really deals with the birth and the sort of the ceremonial beginnings of Jesus Christ entering into this world. And That's really what the chapter is, and I didn't know where necessarily to start and end a thought here. You got the manger, you got the shepherds, you got the Simeon and Anna, and all these folks that are around the birth and sort of the ceremonial things that accompany that in Jesus Christ here, but the first seven verses, I don't think I've ever necessarily dealt with a geographical location as a sermon, but we're going to do it this morning. We're going to attempt to. And I love the way Luke writes history and records history. He's detailed, and when you study out archaeology, and for a long time, his details were contested by historians. They said there's no such thing as a man named Quirinius. There was no such person until they started finding evidence that, yeah, this governor really existed. And this taxation that happened in a pretty small time frame, because the way Luke details who's in charge, who's conducting the taxation, which was part of a census of the Roman Empire, but the way he details it, it really limits it to a particular place in history, and there's of all the information about what's going on at this time, it's you've got Caesar Augustus taxing the world, but the bigger event that's going on is not the taxation of the world, it's the birth of Jesus Christ. And it's almost like the birth of Jesus Christ is what makes Caesar Augustus famous, because nobody would know who he is unless Jesus Christ is born, and really Jesus Christ truly is literally the center of history, because 2023, that's 2023 years after the birth of Christ. He literally is the center point of history. And so that said, the historical stuff really fascinates me. I think it may be more so than I can convey to y'all, so I'm going to try not to be as much historian, but just preach this stuff. But there's a contrast in Luke chapter 2, and we're going to cover the first seven verses. There really is a contrast between two kingdoms in these verses. There is heaven's kingdom that's come to earth, and there is the earthly Roman Empire. And really, it's sort of the beginning stages of the Roman Empire. Rome has been a nation for several hundred years, but it was a nation in disarray up until Caesar Augustus, which we'll talk a little more about him. But I want to read, to get us started here, these first seven verses. And I'm not going to talk about Rome this morning. I'm going to talk about Bethlehem. Luke chapter 2, verse 1 says, "And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. And this taxing was first made when Quirinius was governor of Syria. All right, so there's details. Who's in charge of this particular taxation of Judah? Who's responsible for it? What's Quirinius? And all went to be taxed, everyone into his own country or his own city. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, out of the city of Nazareth into Judea, unto the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be taxed with Mary, his espoused wife, being great with child. And so it was that while they were there, the days were accomplished that she should be delivered. And she brought forth her firstborn son, wrapped him in swaddling clothes, laid him in a manger because there was no room for them in the inn. This is how God, manifest in the flesh, enters into this world. This is the events that surround the birth of Jesus Christ, who is God manifest in the flesh. And these are the events that surround his birth into this world. Like I said, he is the center. This time marks the center of history. It's either marked forward or backward from this. This is ground zero for history. You've got, like I said, 2023 years. That's the year we're in, 2023. After this point in time in history, the birth of Jesus Christ. And so there is a little bit of information here just to get an understanding of where you are in history. One of the censuses that Caesar Augustus takes, he takes several, and every time there's a census taken, there's taxation involved. That's actually an Old Testament rule about censuses. When someone is counted for, they have to bring some payment. That's in the Old Testament. We just dealt with some of that in Samuel when David numbers the people, but this particular time, there's about 4.2 million people in the Roman Empire. Just to get an idea of where you are in the world now, there are 4.2 million people in Houston, and so it is. We're dealing with a vastly larger population at this point in time. And someone said the other day, if you're 40 years old, the population of the world in your lifetime has doubled. And I know people use that for scare tactics and stuff like that, but there's just more people. So at this time, Caesar Augustus, whose name was Octavius before, he is the head of the Roman Empire. He actually creates what would be known as the Roman Empire. Just a little bit of history. Rome has been a nation for about 500 years at this time. And now it's a kind of a nation in disarray. And people are fighting. There's infighting. Augustus, who is Octavius, his adopted dad was Julius Caesar, who was assassinated in the Senate by a number of people. And I think they said he was stabbed like 27 times. Shakespeare wrote a play about it. But that was his stepdad. And Julius Caesar had willed his political and financial power to Octavian. And so Octavian at 19 years old has this... legitimate claim to Rome and the nation, really, but he's not really in charge. They're so broken and fractured. The nation is just so broken and fractured. But that's kind of the beginnings of this guy who is Caesar Augustus, and we'll talk more about that in a little bit. But at the time of Christ's birth, the powerful Roman Empire was going to be used by God's kingdom. This is so interesting. So interesting. It's going to be used by God's kingdom to do God's business. And a couple things I want to make note of. Bethlehem is not, there's nothing really significant about the city of Bethlehem other than David was from Bethlehem. That's the significance. So God's concern with Bethlehem is that the man that he chose to be king is connected to the city. And so that's the significance. I always wondered, why is Jesus born in Bethlehem? Why not Jerusalem? Why not somewhere else? What's the significance of it? And that's the way I kind of think about it. I want to know why these things happen. How do they work? Why are they working this way? Why is this important? And so it's significant because David is from Bethlehem. David happens to be the king who is the man after God's own heart. He is the king that God selected back in 1 Samuel. He's the king that God selected. And so Bethlehem, number one, was a royal place. Not that it was extravagant, not that it was a big city, not that it really had any particular, I don't know, anything of note other than to God. It was important because his king was from there. His original king, the man he selected, was from there. So it's also called, you'll notice in verse 4, the city of David. It's called the city of David. It's where David's from. Therefore, it would be forever connected to God's choice for king. So when the Messiah shows up, when Jesus Christ shows up, God is going to make sure his king is connected to this place. The place that God had originally chosen David from. So that's why this happens. Bethlehem's a royal place. The man after God's own heart, David, would be king of Israel. And he's from this little town. Therefore, the real man after God's own heart, who would be Jesus Christ, is going to be from this town. So let me show you a prophecy in this. Look in Micah chapter 5. This is why Micah says what he says about Bethlehem. Why is it important? What's the importance? Well, it's not really significant to people necessarily, but it's significant to God. And I'll tell you, the more I read the Bible and put things like, think about things like this and how they're put together, it would be impossible. It's just mind-boggling that men could put together something so detailed and care about so many things that we find insignificant, but God cares about it. And it shows and it reveals something about God that we need to know, but it's just, if you took the Bible just as a story, it would have to be divine because there's so many connections, so much foreshadowing, so many things that man can't either figure out or he just can't do. He wouldn't be able to put these things together or even think about these things. Bethlehem, here's Micah's prophecy. About 700 years before the birth of Jesus Christ, Micah the prophet is castigating the rulership and the heads of, the leadership in Jerusalem. And he says, this leadership is bad. It's terrible. And so he says this in a prophecy. But thou, verse 2, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though thou be little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of thee shall he come forth unto me, that is to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth have been from old, from everlasting. So Micah, 700 years before the birth of Jesus Christ, he criticizes and judges in a righteous way the leadership in Jerusalem, and he turns his gaze toward Bethlehem and says, but Bethlehem, out of you shall come a ruler whose goings forth have been from of old, and that will be God's ruler. And so God is forever connected to this little town that has really no significance to anyone else other than God chose David. David is a man after God's own heart, and David was the king of Israel, and yep, he's a man, he's flawed, all that stuff. So when the true Christ, when God's real man shows up, he's going to be from Bethlehem, as Micah says it. So Bethlehem is, first of all, it's a royal place. It's a place of royalty. At least in heaven's kingdom, it's a place of royalty. This is where royalty stems from, Bethlehem. Second thing I want you to think about. And there's some more history here, but Bethlehem is a providential place. When you think about the mechanics of what's going on, just people's lives, Mary and Joseph, they're from Nazareth. What would make a couple from Nazareth, particularly when she's pregnant, travel to Bethlehem? Why would they even go to Bethlehem? I mean, if you're pregnant, you probably want to stay around close to the house and all that. What in the world would compel Mary and Joseph, who are about to give birth to, well, Mary is about to give birth to Jesus Christ in Bethlehem? But you got to move Mary and Joseph to Bethlehem. This Bethlehem is a providential place. It's where the crossroads of it's so wild, the will of God Almighty and heaven's kingdom meet the will of the Roman Empire. It's pretty wild here. So a couple of things about this. In Roman history, I gave you a little bit about how Caesar Augustus became, at least inherited, the political and financial power of his uncle, became his stepdad. But after Julius Caesar is assassinated, and he wills what he does to his nephew, Octavius had proven to be a pretty good soldier. And at 19, he'd proven to be a pretty good soldier. And the final really straw that unified Rome under him was, he had fought several battles, led several victories. But finally, the main problem and the main division in the Roman Empire was between the Caesars and Mark Antony. And so Octavius goes to this place called Actium, where Mark Antony and Cleopatra are. Cleopatra is actually he was a stepmother to Octavian before all this, before she got connected to Mark Antony. Anyhow, so, you know, it's all in the family and everything. And so Octavian goes over to Actium and defeats Mark Antony and all of his armies and all of this division in Rome. And this is about 35 years old or so. And he defeats Mark Antony. Mark Antony ends up killing himself. Cleopatra, same. And after they've been thoroughly defeated, and Octavius goes back to Rome, and he is the undisputed now ruler of Rome. There's no the division has been put down, and so he either encouraged the Senate to do this, or he did it himself, or the Senate did it. But his name became not Octavian anymore. It was Caesar Augustus. They called him Caesar Augustus now. And in 27 BC, 27 years before Jesus Christ is born, that is really the beginning of the Roman Empire. Now he has consolidated all this power, and he becomes really the undisputed king and leader of the Roman Empire. And I say all that, you know, this is what's happening on the world stage. And this is what's important to the world. This is what's important to the world history. And so after Caesar Augustus really takes the reins there, he'll conduct over a period of, I don't know, he's Caesar for a long time. He'll conduct several censuses, try to account for a rapidly growing Roman Empire, And when I say rapidly growing, that means he's taking more territory. He's just growing the country and just taking more territory. And not that he was necessarily a bad tyrant or anything. He was actually politically more probably conservative in the way he dealt with his own people and Rome and trying to recover what made Rome great and stuff like that. But as his nation grows, as his influence grows, there's a general, there's one of the men that works for him, a general named Quirinius, and he's over in Syria, and he takes some land, including Judea. And so after he takes this land and occupies this land, he becomes governor over the place he took. So Quirinius is the governor at the time of this particular taxation. And when Luke marks all this down, he's very detailed. And he's saying, look, this was the taxation when Quirinius was governor. So you can locate this in history. I love the way Luke puts it later on. He says, when the shepherds hear what's going on, they say, let us see that which has come to pass. Meaning this is a historical event. This happened in time. This happened in geography, in a particular place in the world with real people. And so here's Quirinius, and he becomes the governor over this land that he's conquered, including Judea. And at this particular time, he's conducting a taxation and kind of a coupled with a census, just trying to account for how many people are in this rapidly expanding Roman Empire. And Luke marks all that down. But the most important event of all of this is not the taxation. It's not who's governor. It's not Caesar Augustus and how he's building the Roman Empire. When heaven looks down on earth, the most important thing happening on earth is the birth of this little baby. God doesn't care about who's Caesar. He doesn't care about who's governor in Syria. In fact, you and I probably wouldn't even know who Caesar Augustus is were it not for the birth of Jesus Christ. Just never know who he is. And so when heaven looks down, and when God the Father looks down, the most important event is not happening in Rome. The most important event in human history is happening in this little town called Bethlehem. That's what's important to God, and that's so fascinating. When you read the Bible, it's so fascinating to find out, and I know I've said it 100 times, but it's so fascinating to find out what is important to God versus what is important to people. People read history, Caesar Augustus, Julius Caesar, William Shakespeare. Let's write a play about Julius Caesar. He's important. He's a great political figure. Caesar Augustus, he commanded the Roman Empire. He grew the Roman Empire. And God says, they come and go. People like that come and go. I see people like that all the time. Generations of people. The most important thing happening to God the Father, to heaven, is in a little town called Bethlehem with this little baby and this little couple, Mary and Joseph. And that is the most important thing to God. And that is, I would say, becomes the most important thing in history. These taxations, I mean, there is no one in this room, probably, that has any relationship, any effect, any lasting circumstance, lasting something that's lasting in your life that came from what Caesar Augustus did back in 0 AD. But there is something that happened in Bethlehem that affects everybody in this room. And affects not only all of us in this room, but everybody in the world. Why? Because it was important to God. And it was important to God, so it's going to be lasting, and a lasting event. This is where Bethlehem is where the crossroads of it's I don't want to say place of destiny, but it's just a place where the divine, the kingdom of heaven, and it's personalized and put into context and put into this world and this system and this planet, and it's a place where all of these things come together. It's interesting, just a note, Luke's details here, where he says in parentheses, this taxing was first made when Quirinius was governor of Syria. Like I said, for a long time, historians were skeptical. They said, well, Luke's lying because there's no such thing as this guy, Quirinius. There's no such record of any of this until they start finding records of this. And as time goes on, you know what happens as time goes on? The truths in the Bible become more and more purified. They become more and more clear. They become more and more proven. And as time goes on, things in the world, world events that really don't have that much influence, I'd say influence, they don't last that long. Things like a global taxation by Caesar Augustus, you know how important that is right now? It doesn't matter. So over time, this event has lost so much importance. You know why? Because it's just a man-made event. But God, when God gets involved in something, now this event in time, this birth of Jesus Christ, it's grown in influence. It becomes more important as time goes on. That's the nature of a divine book and a divine record and divine events in history. Most important event is not Caesar's taxation. Most important event is the birth of the Savior. So how does God the Father get Mary and Joseph, who are from Nazareth, to an insignificant city like Bethlehem? Well, he uses a Roman Empire who taxes a nation and says, move back to your home place. Not move back, but get back to your home place so they can take a record of you and take your money. And so God uses that, gets Mary and Joseph over to Bethlehem, and what do you know? Just happens that when Mary and Joseph get to Bethlehem, Mary has a baby. And the baby is Christ, and the baby has been promised, and they've already gone through the virgin shall conceive and all that kind of stuff. So God uses this global taxation to get this little family to this little town called Bethlehem. Why? Because Bethlehem is important to God. It may not be important to you, but it's important to God. It may not be important to anybody else, but it's important to God. Why is it important to God? Because God's choice for king came from Bethlehem. And God's real choice for king is going to come from Bethlehem. So God uses this taxation, moves this little family back to Bethlehem, at least for a period of time. And Mary just happens to have a baby there. What do you know? Third thing about Bethlehem. So not only is Bethlehem, it is a royal place, it's a providential place, it is also this place where there's so much foreshadowing here. It's also a place where there's just no room for the king. Verse 7 says, she brought forth her firstborn son, wrapped him in swaddling clothes, and laid him in a manger because there's no room for them in the inn. So the Lord gets Mary and Joseph over to Bethlehem to create the record. Yeah, we're a part of David's family. Yeah, here's our money. Here's a taxation here. And when they get there, they can't find any place to stay. They can't find any place to sleep other than this stable. Why is Jesus Christ going to be in a manger? He's going to be in a manger because there's no place for him to be. And you think about some of the spiritual application to that. Boy, you could probably preach on that. And it's not only a physical reality that there is no place for Mary and Joseph and this new baby, Jesus Christ. Not only is it a physical reality, but it is a spiritual reality. That there would be no place in this world for Christ. There would be no place, and because there's no place in this world system, God would periodically intervene. Sometimes he would periodically move the chess pieces, so to speak. But in this system, in this world, the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, the pride of life, there is no Christ. There is no room for Christ. And in this great statement that Luke makes, that's a reality in their lives at the time, there's no room. It's also a great spiritual statement that there's just no room because, why? Because maybe inconvenience. We talked about stuff like this at Christmas time. This innkeeper, I'm sure, it's just too inconvenient. How do you kick people out? How do you get rid of people and tell them, no, I need you to go sleep in the stable and I'm going to let these people in. Why are you going to let these people in? We already paid our money. No room because of just, it's just too inconvenient. But I think about that with the innkeeper and with, some of the spiritual truths that come out of that. You know, as an innkeeper, it's and I've said it, I mean, it's hard to get probably paying guests out. But this is a great spiritual truth. How much room in your life is there for Jesus Christ? You know, the world, there's no place in the world for Jesus Christ. So the more your life lines up with this world system, you find less and less place for Jesus Christ. There's just less place for him, to the point that there's no place for him. I can't find a way to fit him in. I can't find a way to fit him into my life. But here's what religion does. If you're that innkeeper, I'm putting a lot into this story here, but if you're that innkeeper and you come to find out that the Messiah, the Christ, was at your inn, you know what you might be inclined to tell people? You know who stayed here? Jesus stayed here. Don't tell him the rest of the story, though. He didn't really stay here. He was put in the barn. He didn't really stay here. But that's what might be a good marketing thing. Jesus stayed here. I think that's religion. That's what religion does. We want to claim Jesus, but we don't really want him here. We want to talk about how he's been around here. But we don't really want to have a place for him here. We want to keep doing what we're doing, but also say, hey, Jesus is also here. Well, he's not here if he's in the stable. He's not here. You don't get to claim the presence of Jesus Christ after you put him out. You don't get to keep saying, yeah, Jesus is here. He's in my life. Think about this. We've talked about this before, but I hear this phrase, I invited Jesus into my life. Have y'all heard that phrase? I invited Jesus into my life. And sometimes it shows that some people really did. I mean, Jesus is obviously a part of their life. But not for everybody. Hear this phrase, oh, I invited Jesus into my life. And you take a look at their life and you're like, okay, so what part of your life did you invite Jesus into? What do you mean you invited him into your heart? What part of your heart is he in? I mean, because you don't have time for him. And then you don't make time for him. You do basically what you want to do. Yet, I invited Jesus into my life. Well, if you invite someone into your life, then they occupy some space there. And they probably have some influence somewhere. But to just say, I invited Jesus into my life, like the innkeeper, hey, yeah, Jesus stayed here. Well, did he really stay here? I mean, he wasn't really here. He was in the stable because you didn't have room for him. So you don't get to not have room for him and then say,
Yeah, oh yeah, Jesus, he's a big part of my life. I invited him into my heart. Okay. Well, and if you're of that mindset, and if you've done that, and if you say things like that, examine your own life. When you say stuff like, I invited Jesus into my heart, well, what part of your heart did you invite him into? What space, what room does he occupy now in your life? Where does he live? What is he? What place of influence does he have? It's such a perfect foreshadowing, an explanation. Really, he says there's no room. There was no room for him. I think sometimes non-religious people have a much better understanding of Christianity than professing Christians. Because I've heard it, and you probably heard it too. Somebody says, yeah, I don't really want to invite Jesus into my life because it means I need to change this and this. Oh, so you understand Jesus and this aren't compatible. They don't go together. He can't occupy this room while there's other guests in this room. And sometimes lost people get that. They understand, well, if I invite Jesus in, then these other things are going to have to leave. Seems like the only time this doesn't make sense is when people want to be real spiritual about or seem real spiritual about this stuff. This is just practical stuff. It's if I, as an innkeeper, let Jesus into my inn, obviously people are going to have to go. I can't just put him in a room with other people. And the innkeeper understands it, and what does he do? Well, it's just inconvenient. I don't want to house you because, I mean, there's a place in the stable, but I don't have any room for you. Maybe there's no room because of the inconvenience it poses. Maybe there's no room because you just rather want to believe he's here without him actually being here, which is kind of what we talked about. This is religion. I want to be able to say Jesus is in my life without him actually being in my life. I want to say he's a part, he's come into my heart without him actually doing anything in my heart. That's religion. And you've heard that phrase and I've heard that phrase. So Jesus Christ, to sum up the first seven verses here, grand event on Earth's historical scale. Caesar Augustus, he makes the taxation of the whole world. And he accounts for all of the citizens in this rapidly expanding Roman Empire. And that event is just a footnote to the birth of Jesus Christ. It's just a marker in history. Oh, by the way, Caesar Augustus was taxing all the people, and this is when Quirinius was governor. That's when Jesus was born. And you know what the important event is? When Jesus was born. You know what the event that has influence 2,000 years later? When Jesus was born. You know what event doesn't have any influence 2,000 years later? When Caesar Augustus was taxing people. Nobody cares now. No, it doesn't matter. It's just a footnote in history. But Jesus Christ, not a footnote in history. An influence. A person. A real changing or powerful, able to change person that can renew lives, that can rescue from sin, that can bring light into the darkness, Jesus Christ. That's the important thing. And Luke is carefully detailing this history and showing, okay, here's what's happening in Rome. But here's what's happening in Bethlehem. Why is Bethlehem important? Well, Bethlehem is connected to royalty. That's why it's important. Whose royalty? God's royalty. It's connected to God's royalty. Why is Bethlehem important? It's the crossroads. It's a place of providence where God would use a world leader to get a little family into a town that he wants them to be in so that he can connect his king to the king that he had chosen years ago, David, the city of David. And when they get there, they find Bethlehem is a crowded place, a state of not only the physical reality of the place, there's no, just no place for him, but it's much a spiritual reality. There's no place in the morals. There's no place for him in the ideas. There's no place for him in the education. There's no place for him in the finance. There's just no place for Christ. But we want to invite Christ into our heart and have that ability to claim Jesus Christ without him actually occupying space there. Kind of like Bethlehem. Bethlehem's a crowded place. And so Jesus Christ, as the Lamb of God, which we'll talk about next week, what foreshadowing. He's going to be born in Bethlehem, born in this stable, laid in a manger, surrounded by shepherds. You know what the foreshadowing is? This man is going to be born exactly like he's going to die, as the Lamb of God. Isn't that something? That's something. I think it's something. Pretty good. Pretty interesting stuff. As Sam comes and plays on the piano, I know it's a lot of history, but to see God work in history, to see what's important to God, that's interesting. That's good. That's food for the soul. I love seeing these things. As Sam plays, we'll have a little time of just reflection, meditation. Think about what you've heard. How does it apply to your life? Do you have room for Jesus Christ? Did you just invite him into your heart and now there's no place for him? Is there actual place for Jesus Christ? You need to make some place for him? Maybe you need to make a place for him. Give him some space in your life. Sam plays, we'll have just a little time of reflection.